And what if she was wrong? What if Bob had just found that ID packet by the side of the road or something? Do you know how unlikely that is? Smart Darcy sneered. Okay, yes. But unlikely wasn't the same as impossible, was it? There was something else, too, something that made the cage she was in escape-proof. What if she was right? Wouldn't her death free Bob to kill more, because he no longer had to lead so deep a double life? Darcy wasn't sure she believed in a conscious existence after death, but what if there was one? And what if she were confronted there, not by Edenic green fields and rivers of plenty, but by a ghastly receiving line of strangled women branded by her husband's teeth, all accusing her of causing their deaths by taking the easy way out herself, and by ignoring what she had found, if such a thing were even possible, which she didn't believe for a minute. Wouldn't the accusation be true? Did she really think she could condemn more women to horrible deaths just so her daughter could have a nice June wedding? She thought, I wish I was dead. But she wasn't. For the first time in years, Darcy Madsen Anderson slipped from her chair onto her knees and began to pray. It did no good. The house was empty except for her. Seven. She had never kept a diary, but she had 10 years' worth of appointment books stored in the bottom of her capacious sewing chest, and decades' worth of Bob's travel records stuffed in one of the file drawers of the cabinet he kept in his home office. As a tax accountant, and one with his own duly incorporated side business to boot, he was meticulous when it came to record keeping, taking every deduction, tax credit, and cent of automotive depreciation he could. She stacked his files beside her computer, along with her appointment books. She opened Google and forced herself to do the research she needed, noting the names and dates of death. Some of these were necessarily approximate of Beattie's victims. Then, as the digital clock on her computer's control strip marched soundlessly past 10 p.m., she began the laborious work of cross-checking. She would have given a dozen years of her life to find something that would have indisputably eliminated him from even one of the murders. But her appointment books only made things worse. Kelly Gervais of Keene, New Hampshire, had been discovered in the woods behind the local landfill on March 15th of 2004. According to the medical examiner, she had been dead 3 to 5 days. Scrawled across March 10th to 12th in Darcy's appointment book for 2004 was Bob to Fitzwilliam, Brat. George Fitzwilliam was a well-heeled client of Benson, Bacon, and Anderson. Brat was her abbreviation for Brattleboro, where Fitzwilliam lived. An easy drive from Keene, New Hampshire. Helen Shaverstone and her son Robert had been discovered in Newry Creek, in the town of Amesbury, on November 11th of 2007. They had lived in Tassel Village, some 12 miles away. On the November page of her 2007 address book, she had drawn a line across the 8th to the 10th, scrawling, Bob in Saugus, 2 estate sales, plus Boston Coinock. And did she remember calling his Saugus motel on one of those nights and not getting him? Assuming he was out late with some coin salesman, sniffing for leads or maybe in the shower. She seemed to remember that. If so, had he actually been on the road that night? Perhaps coming back from doing an errand, a little drop-off, in the town of Amesbury? Or if he had been in the shower, what in God's name had he been washing off? She turned to his travel records and vouchers as the clock on the control strip passed 11 and started climbing toward midnight, the witching hour when the graveyards reputedly yawned. She worked carefully and stopped often to double-check. The stuff from the late 70s was spotty and not much help. He hadn't been much more than your basic office drone in those days, but everything from the 80s was there. and the correlations she found for the Beattie murders in 1980 and 1981 were clear and undeniable. He had been traveling at the right times and in the right areas. And Smart Darcy insisted, if you found enough cat hairs in a person's house, you pretty much had to assume there was a feline on the premises somewhere. So what do I do now? The answer seemed to be, carry her confused and frightened head upstairs. She doubted if she could sleep, but at least she could take a hot shower and then lie down. She was exhausted. Her back ached from throwing up, and she stank of her own sweat. She shut off her computer and climbed to the second floor at a slow trudge. The shower eased her back, and a couple of Tylenol would probably ease it more by 2 a.m. or so. She was sure she'd be awake to find out. When she put the Tylenol back in the medicine cabinet, she took the Ambien bottle out, held it in her hand for almost a full minute, then replaced that too. It wouldn't put her to sleep, only make her muzzy and, perhaps, more paranoid than she was already. She lay down and looked at the night table on the other side of the bed. Bob's clock. Bob's spare set of reading glasses. A copy of a book called The Shack.
You ought to read this, Darce. It's a life changer, he'd said two or three nights before this latest trip.
She turned off her lamp, saw Stacy Moore stuffed into the corn bin, and turned the lamp back on again. On most nights, the dark was her friend, sleep's kindly harbinger. But not tonight. Tonight the dark was populated by Bob's harem. You don't know that. Remember that you don't absolutely know that.
But if you find enough cat hairs...
Enough with the cat hairs, too. She lay there, even more wide awake than she'd feared she'd be, her mind going around and around, now thinking of the victims, now thinking of her children, now thinking of herself, even thinking of some long-forgotten Bible story about Jesus praying in the Garden of Gethsemane. She glanced at Bob's clock after what felt like an hour of going around that wretched worry circle, and saw that only 12 minutes had passed. She got up on one elbow and turned the clock's face to the window. He won't be home until 6 tomorrow night, she thought. Although since it was now 12:15, she supposed it was technically tonight that he'd be home. Still, that gave her 18 hours. Surely enough time to make some sort of decision. It would help if she could sleep, even a little. Sleep had a way of resetting the mind. But it was out of the question. She would drift a little, then think Marjorie Duval or Stacy Moore or, this was the worst, Robert Shaverstone, 10 years old. He did not suffer. And then any possibility of sleep would again be gone. The idea that she might never sleep again came to her. That was impossible, of course. But lying here with the taste of puke still in her mouth, in spite of the scope she had rinsed with, it seemed completely plausible. At some point, she found herself remembering the year in early childhood, when she had gone around the house looking in mirrors. She would stand in front of them with her hands cupped to the sides of her face, and her nose touching the glass, but holding her breath so she wouldn't fog the surface. If her mother caught her, she'd swat her away. That leaves a smudge, and I have to clean it off. Why are you so interested in yourself anyway? You'll never be hung for your beauty. And why stand so close? You can't see anything worth looking at that way.
How old had she been? 4? 5?
Too young to explain that it wasn't her reflection she was interested in anyway. Or not primarily. She had been convinced that mirrors were doorways to another world, and what she saw reflected in the glass wasn't their living room or bathroom, but the living room or bathroom of some other family. The Matsons, instead of the Madsons, perhaps. Because it was similar on the other side of the glass, but not the same. And if you looked long enough, you could begin to pick up on some of the differences. a rug that appeared to be oval over there instead of round, like over here. A door that seemed to have a turn latch instead of a bolt. A light switch that was on the wrong side of the door. The little girl wasn't the same either. Darcy was sure they were related. Sisters of the Mirror. But no, not the same. Instead of Darcelyn Madsen, that little girl might be named Jane or Sandra or even Eleanor Rigby, who for some reason, some scary reason, picked up the rice at churches where a wedding had been. Lying in the circle of her bedside lamp, drowsing without realizing it, Darcy supposed that if she had been able to tell her mother what she was looking for, if she had explained about the darker girl who wasn't quite her, she might have passed some time with the child psychiatrist. But it wasn't the girl who interested her. It had never been the girl. What interested her was the idea that there was a whole other world behind the mirrors. And if you could walk through that other house, the darker house, and out the door, the rest of that world would be waiting. Of course, this idea had passed, and, aided by a new doll, which she had named Mrs. Butterworth after the pancake syrup she loved, and a new dollhouse, she had moved on to the more acceptable little girl fantasies, cooking, cleaning, shopping, scolding the baby, changing for dinner. Now, all these years later, she had found her way through the mirror after all. Only there was no little girl waiting in the darker house. Instead, there was a darker husband, one who had been living behind the mirror all the time, and doing terrible things there.
A good one at a fair price, Bob liked to say. An accountant's credo, if ever there was one. Upright and sniffing the air,
an answer to, "How you doing?"
that every kid in every Cub Scout pack he'd ever taken down Dead Man's Trail knew well. A response some of those boys no doubt still repeated as grown men. Gentlemen prefer blondes, don't forget that one, because they get tired of squeezing.
But then sleep took Darcy, and although that soft nurse could not carry her far, the lines on her forehead and at the corners of her reddened, puffy eyes softened a bit. She was close enough to consciousness to stir when her husband pulled into the driveway. But not close enough to come around. She might have if the Suburban's headlights had splashed across the ceiling, but Bob had doused them halfway down the block so as not to wake her.
8.
A cat was stroking her cheek with a velvet paw, very lightly but very insistently. Darcy tried to brush it away, but her hand seemed to weigh 1,000 pounds. And it was a dream, anyway. Surely had to be. They had no cat. Although if there are enough cat hairs in a house, there must be one around somewhere, her struggling to wake mind told her, quite reasonably. Now the paw was stroking her bangs and the forehead beneath. And it couldn't be a cat, because cats don't talk.
"Wake up, Darce. Wake up, hon. We have to talk."
The voice, as soft and soothing as the touch. Bob's voice. And not a cat's paw, but a hand. Bob's hand. Only it couldn't be him, because he was in Her eyes flew open, and he was there, all right, sitting beside her on the bed, stroking her face and hair as he sometimes did when she was feeling under the weather. He was wearing a 3-piece Joseph A. Banks suit. He bought all his suits there, calling it, another of his semi-amusing sayings, Joss Bank. But the vest was unbuttoned and his collar undone. She could see the end of his tie poking out of his coat pocket like a red tongue. His midsection bulged over his belt, and her first coherent thought was, "You really have to do something about your weight, Bobby. That isn't good for your heart."
"What?"
It came out an almost incomprehensible crow croak. He smiled and kept stroking her hair, her cheek, the nape of her neck. She cleared her throat and tried again.
"What are you doing here, Bobby? It must be..."
She raised her head to look at his clock, which of course did no good. She had turned its face to the wall. He glanced down at his watch. He had been smiling as he stroked her awake, and was smiling now.
3:15. I sat in my stupid old motel room for almost 2 hours after we talked, trying to convince myself that what I was thinking couldn't be true. Only I didn't get to where I am by dodging the truth. So I jumped in the Bourbon and hit the road. No traffic whatsoever. I don't know why I don't do more traveling late at night. Maybe I will. If I'm not in Shawshank, that is. Or New Hampshire State Prison in Concord. But that's kinda up to you, isn't it?
His hand, stroking her face, the feel of it was familiar. Even the smell of it was familiar. And she had always loved it. Now she didn't, and it wasn't just the night's wretched discoveries. How could she have never noticed how complacently possessive that stroking touch was?
You're an old bitch, but you're my old bitch, that touch now seemed to say. Only this time you piddled on the floor while I was gone, and that's bad. In fact, it's a big bad.
She pushed his hand away and sat up. What? In God's name, are you talking about? You come sneaking in, you wake me up.
Yes, you were sleeping with the light on. I saw it as soon as I turned up the driveway.
There was no guilt in his smile. Nothing sinister either. It was the same sweet-natured Bob Anderson smile she'd loved almost from the first. For a moment, her memory flickered over how gentle he'd been on their wedding night. Not hurrying her, giving her time to get used to the new thing. Which he will do now, she thought.
You never sleep with a light on, Darce. And although you've got your nightgown on, you're wearing your bra under it, and you never do that either. You just forgot to take it off, didn't you? Poor darling. Poor tired girl.
For just a moment he touched her breast, then, thankfully, took his hand away.
Also, you turned my clock around so you wouldn't have to look at the time. You've been upset, and I'm the cause. I'm sorry, Darce. From the bottom of my heart.
I ate something that disagreed with me.
It was all she could think of. He smiled patiently.
You found my special hiding place in the garage.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Ah, you did a good job of putting things back where you found them. But I'm very careful about such things. And the strip of tape I put on above the pivot in the baseboard was broken. You didn't notice that, did you? Why would you? It's the kind of tape that's almost invisible once it's on. Also, the box inside was 1 or 2 to the left of where I put it. Where I always put it.
He reached to stroke her cheek some more, then withdrew his hand, seemingly without rancor, when she turned her face away.
Bobby, I can see you've got a bee in your bonnet about something, but I honestly don't know what it is. Maybe you've been working too hard.
His mouth turned down in a moo of sadness, and his eyes were moistening with tears.
Incredible! She actually had to stop herself from feeling sorry for him.
Emotions were only another human habit, it seemed, as conditioned as any other.
I guess I always knew this day would come.
I haven't got the slightest idea what you're talking about, he sighed.
I had a long ride back to think about this, honey. And the longer I thought, the harder I thought. The more it seemed like there was really only one question that needed an answer. W-W-D-D.
I don't...
Hush, he said,
and put a gentle finger on her lips. She could smell soap. He must have showered before he left the motel, a very Bob-like thing to do.
I'll tell you everything. I'll make a clean breast. I think that down deep. I've always wanted you to know.
He'd always wanted her to know. Dear God, there might be worse things waiting, but this was easily the most terrible thing so far. I don't want to know. Whatever it is you've got stuck in your head, I don't want to know.
I see something different in your eyes, honey, and I've gotten very good at reading women's eyes. I've become something of an expert. WWDD stands for What Would Darcy Do? In this case, what would Darcy do if she found my special hiding place and what's inside my special box? I've always loved that box, by the way, because you gave it to me.
He leaned forward and planted a quick kiss between her brows. His lips were moist. For the first time in her life, the touch of them on her skin revolted her, and it occurred to her that she might be dead before the sun came up, because dead women told no tales. Although, she thought, he'd try to make sure I didn't suffer.
First I asked myself if the name Marjorie Duval would mean anything to you. I would have liked to answer that question with a big old no. But sometimes a fella has to be a realist. You're not the world's number one news junkie, but I've lived with you long enough to know that you follow the main stories on TV and in the newspaper. I thought you'd know the name. And even if you didn't, I thought you'd recognize the picture on the driver's license, because I said to myself, won't she be curious as to why I have those ID cards? Women are always curious. Look at Pandora.
Or Bluebeard's wife, she thought. The woman who peeked into the locked room and found the severed heads of all her predecessors in matrimony. Bob, I swear to you, I don't have any idea what you're talking.
So the first thing I did when I came in was to boot up your computer. Open Firefox, that's the web browser you always use, and check the history.
The what?
He chuckled as if she'd gotten off an exceptionally witty line. You don't even know. I didn't think you did, because every time I check, everything's there. You never clear it. And he chuckled again, as a man will do when a wife exhibits a trait he finds particularly endearing. Darcy felt the first thin stirrings of anger. Probably absurd, given the circumstances, but there it was.
You check my computer? You sneak! You dirty sneak!
Of course I check. I have a very bad friend who does very bad things. A man in a situation like that has to keep current with those closest to him. Since the kids left home, that's you and only you.
Bad friend.
A bad friend who does bad things. Her head was swimming. But one thing seemed all too clear. Further denials would be useless. She knew, and he knew she did. You haven't just been checking on Marjorie Duval.
She heard no shame or defensiveness in his voice, only a hideous regret that it should have come to this.
You've been checking on all of them. Then he laughed and said, "Whoops!"
She sat up against the headboard, which pulled her slightly away from him. That was good. Distance was good. All those years she'd lain with him hip to hip and thigh to thigh, and now distance was good. What bad friend? What are you talking about?
He cocked his head to one side, Bob's body language for, "I find you dense, but amusingly so." Brian.
At first, she had no idea who he was talking about and thought it must be someone from work. Possibly an accomplice. It didn't seem likely on the face of it. She would have said Bob was as lousy at making friends as she was. But men who did such things sometimes did have accomplices. Wolves hunted in packs, after all.
Brian Delahanty, he said. Don't tell me you forgot Brian. I told you all about him after you told me about what happened to Brandolin.
Her mouth dropped open. Your friend from junior high? Bob, he's
dead. He got hit by a truck while he was chasing down a baseball, and he's dead.
Well, Bob's smile grew apologetic. Yes and no. I almost always called him Brian when I talked about him to you, but that's not what I called him back in school, because he hated that name. I called him by his initials. I called him BD.
She started to ask him what that had to do with the price of tea in China, but then she knew. Of course she knew. BD. BD.
9. He talked for a long time, and the longer he talked, the more horrified she became. All these years she'd been living with a madman. But how could she have known? His insanity was like an underground sea. There was a layer of rock over it, and a layer of soil over the rock. Flowers grew there. You could stroll through them and never know the mad water was there. But it was. It always had been. He blamed BD, who had become BD only years later in his notes to the police, for everything. But Darcy suspected Bob knew better than that. Blaming Brian Delahanty only made it easier to keep his two lives separate. It had been BD's idea to take guns to school and go on a rampage, for instance. According to Bob, this inspiration had occurred in the summer between their freshman and sophomore years at Castle Rock High School.
1971, he said, shaking his head good-naturedly, as a man might do when recalling some harmless childhood peccadillo. Long before those Columbine oafs were even a twinkle in their daddy's eyes. There were these girls that snooted us. Diane Ramage, Lori Swenson, Gloria Haggerty. There were a couple of others, too. But I forget their names. The plan was to get a bunch of guns. Brian's dad had about 20 rifles and pistols in his basement, including a couple of German Lugers from World War II that we were just fascinated with, and take them to school. No searches or metal detectors back then, you know. We were going to barricade ourselves in the science wing. We'd chain the doors shut, kill some people, mostly teachers, but also some of the guys we didn't like, and then stampede the rest of the kids outside through the fire door at the far end of the hall. Well, most of the kids. We were going to keep the girls who snooted us as hostages. We planned, BD planned, to do all of this before the cops could get there, right? He drew maps, and he kept a list of the steps we'd have to take in his geometry notebook. I think there were maybe 20 steps in all, starting with, pull fire alarms to create confusion. He chuckled. And after we had the place locked down, he gave her a slightly shamefaced smile, but she thought what he was mostly ashamed of was how stupid the plan had been in the first place. Well, you can probably guess. Couple of teenage boys, hormones so high we got horny when the wind blew. We were going to tell those girls that if they, you know, fuck us real good, we'd let them go. If they didn't, we'd have to kill them. And they'd fuck all right.
He nodded slowly.
They'd fuck to live. BD was right about that.
He was lost in his story. His eyes were hazy with grotesque but true nostalgia. For what? The crazy dreams of youth? She was afraid that might actually be it.
We didn't plan to kill ourselves like those heavy metal dumbbells in Colorado, either. No way. There was a basement under the science wing, and Brian said there was a tunnel down there. He said it went from the supply room to the old fire station on the other side of Route 119. Brian said that when the high school was just a K-8 grammar school back in the 50s, there was a park over there, and the little kids used to play in it at recess. The tunnel was so that they could get to the park without having to cross the road.
Bob laughed, making her jump.
I took his word for all that, but it turns out he was full of shit. I went down there the next fall to look for myself. The supply room was there, full of paper and stinking of that mimeograph juice they used to use. But if there was a tunnel, I never found it. And even back then, I was very thorough. I don't know if he was lying to both of us or just to himself. I only know that there was no tunnel. We would have been trapped upstairs, and who knows, we might have killed ourselves after all. You never know what a 14-year-old's gonna do, do you? They roll around like unexploded bombs.
You're not unexploded anymore, she thought. Are you, Bob?
We probably would have chickened out anyway, but maybe not. Maybe we would have tried to go through with it. BD got me all excited, talking about how we were going to feel them up first, then make them take off each other's clothes.
He looked at her earnestly.
Yes, I know how it sounds. Just boys, jack-off fantasies. But those girls really were snoots. You tried to talk to them, they'd laugh and walk away, then stand in the corner of the calf, the bunch of them, looking us over and laughing some more. So you really couldn't blame us, could you?
He looked at his fingers, drumming restlessly on his suit pants, where they stretched tight over his thighs, then back up at Darcy.
The thing you have to understand, that you really have to see, is how persuasive Brian was. He was lots worse than me. He really was crazy. Plus, it was a time when the whole country was rioting, don't forget, and that was part of it, too.
I doubt it, she thought. The amazing thing was how he made it sound almost normal, as if every adolescent boy's sexual fantasies involved rape and murder. Probably he believed that, just as he had believed in Brian Delahanty's mythical escape tunnel. Or had he? How could she know? She was, after all, listening to the recollections of a lunatic. It was just hard to believe that. Still, because the madman was Bob. Her Bob.
Anyway, he said, shrugging, it never happened. That was the summer Brian ran into the road and got killed. There was a reception at his house after the funeral, and his mother said I could go up to his room and take something if I wanted. As a souvenir, you know. And I did want to. You bet I did. I took his geometry notebook so nobody would go leafing through it and come across his plans for the great Castle Rock shootout and fuck party. That's what he called it, you know.
Bob laughed ruefully.
If I was a religious fella, I'd say God save me from myself. And who knows if there isn't something, some fate, that has its own plan for us.
And this fate's plan for you was for you to torture and kill women? Darcy asked. She couldn't help herself. He looked at her reproachfully.
They were snoots, he said, and raised a teacherly finger. Also, it wasn't me. It was Beatty who did that stuff. And I say did for a reason, Darce. I say did instead of does, because all that's behind me now.
Bob, your friend Beatty is dead. He's been dead for almost 40 years. You must know that. I mean, on some level, you must.
He tossed his hands in the air, a gesture of good-natured surrender. Do you want to call it guilt avoidance? That's what a shrink would call it, I suppose, and it's fine if you do. But Darcy, listen.
He leaned forward and pressed a finger to her forehead between her eyebrows.
Listen and get this through your head. It was Brian. He infected me with, well, certain ideas. Let's say that. Some ideas, once you get them in your head, you can't unthink them. You can't
put the toothpaste back in the tube.
He clapped his hands together, almost making her scream. That's it exactly. You can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. Brian was dead, but the ideas were alive. Those ideas, getting women, doing whatever to them, whatever crazy idea came into your head, they became his ghost.
His eyes shifted upward and to the left when he said this. She had read somewhere that this meant the person who was talking was telling a conscious lie. But did it matter if he was, or which one of them he was lying to? She thought not.
"I won't go into the details," he said. "It's nothing for a sweetheart like you to hear, and like it or not, I know you don't right now. You're still my sweetheart. But you have to know, I fought it. For 7 years, I fought it. But those ideas, Brian's ideas, kept growing inside my head until finally I said to myself, I'll try it once, just to get it out of my head. To get him out of my head. If I get caught, I get caught. At least I'll stop thinking about it. Wondering about it, what it would be like.
You're telling me it was a male exploration, she said dully.
Well, yes, I suppose you could say that.
Or like trying a joint just to see what all the shouting was about.
He shrugged modestly, boyishly.
Kinda.
It wasn't an exploration, Bobby. It wasn't trying a joint. It was taking a woman's life.
She had seen no guilt or shame. Absolutely none. He appeared incapable of those things. It seemed the circuit breaker that controlled them had been fried, perhaps even before birth. But now he gave her a sulky, put-upon look. A teenager's you-don't-understand-me look.
Darcy, they were snoots.
She wanted a glass of water, but she was afraid to get up and go into the bathroom. She was afraid he would stop her. And what would come after that? What then?
Besides, he resumed, I didn't think I'd get caught, not if I was careful and made a plan. Not a half-baked and horny 14-year-old boy's plan, you know? But a realistic one.
And I realized something else, too. I couldn't do it myself. Even if I didn't screw up out of nervousness, I might out of guilt, because I was one of the good guys. That's how I saw myself. And believe it or not, I still do. And I have the proof, don't I? A good home, a good wife, 2 beautiful children who are all grown up and starting their own lives. And I give back to the community. That's why I took the town treasurer's job for 2 years, gratis. That's why I work with Vinnie Eschler every year to put on the Halloween blood drive.
You should have asked Marjorie Duval to give, Darcy thought. She was A positive.
Then, puffing out his chest slightly, a man nailing down his argument with one final, irrefutable point, he said,
That's what the Cub Scouts are about. You thought I'd quit when Donnie went on to Boy Scouts. I know you did. Only I didn't. Because it's not just about him, and never was. It's about the community. It's about giving back.
Then give Marjorie Duval back her life. Or Stacy Moore. Or Robert Shaverstone. That last one got through. He winced as if she had struck him.
The boy was an accident. He wasn't supposed to be there.
But you being there wasn't an accident?
It wasn't me, he said.
Then added the ultimate surreal absurdity.
I'm no adulterer. It was BD. It's always BD. It was his fault for putting those ideas in my head in the first place. I never would have thought of them on my own. I signed my notes to the police with his name just to make that clear. Of course, I changed the spelling because I sometimes called him BD back when I first told you about him. You might not remember that, but I did.
She was impressed by the obsessive lengths he'd gone to. No wonder he hadn't been caught. If she hadn't stubbed her toe on that damned carton.
None of them had any relation to me or my business. Either of my businesses. That would be very bad. Very dangerous. But I travel a lot, and I keep my eyes open. BD, the BD inside, he does too. We watch out for the snooty ones, you can always tell. They wear their skirts too high and show their bra straps on purpose. They entice men. That's Stacy Moore, for instance. You read about her, I'm sure. Married, but that didn't keep her from brushing her titties against me. She worked as a waitress in a coffee shop, the Sunnyside in Waterville. I used to go up there to Mickelson's Coins, remember? You even went with me a couple of times when Pets was at Colby. This was before George Mickelson died and his son sold off all the stock so he could go to New Zealand or somewhere. That woman was all over me, Darce. Always asking me if I wanted a warm-up on my coffee and saying stuff like, "How about those Red Sox?" Bending over, rubbing her titties on my shoulder, trying her best to get me hard. Which she did, I admit it. I'm a man with a man's needs, and although you never turned me away or said no, well, rarely, I'm a man with a man's needs, and I've always been highly sexed. Some women sense that and like to play on it. It gets them off.
He was looking down at his lap with dark, musing eyes. Then something else occurred to him, and his head jerked up.
His thinning hair flew, then settled back. Always smiling. Red lipstick and always smiling. Well, I recognize smiles like that. Most men do. Ha-ha, I know you want it. I can smell it on you. But this little rub's all you're gonna get, so deal with it. I could deal with it, but not BD. Not him.
He shook his head slowly.
There are lots of women like that. It's easy to get their names. Then you can trace them down on the internet. There's a lot of information if you know how to look for it, and accountants know how. I've done that. Dozens of times. Maybe even 100. You could call it a hobby, I guess. You could say I collect information as well as coins. Usually it comes to nothing. But sometimes BD will say, "She's the one you want to follow through on, Bobby. That one right there. We'll make the plan together, and when the time comes, you just let me take over." And that's what I do.
He took her hand and folded her limp and chilly fingers into his.
"You think I'm crazy. I can see it in your eyes, but I'm not, honey. It's BD who's crazy. Or BD, if you like his for the public name better. By the way, if you read the stories in the paper, you know I purposely put a lot of misspellings in my notes to the police. I even misspell the addresses. I keep a list of misspellings in my wallet so that I'll always do it the same way. It's misdirection. I want them to think BD's dumb. Illiterate, anyway. And they do. Because they're dumb. I've only been questioned a single time, years ago. And that was as a witness. About 2 weeks after BD killed the Moore woman, an old guy with a limp, semi-retired, told me to give him a call if I remembered anything. I said I would. That was pretty rich.
He chuckled soundlessly, as he sometimes did when they were watching Modern Family or Two and a Half Men. It was a way of laughing that had, until tonight, always heightened her own amusement.
"You want to know something, Darce? If they caught me dead to rights, I'd admit it. At least I guess I would. I don't think anybody knows 100% for sure what they do in a situation like that. But I couldn't give them much of a confession. Because I don't remember much about the actual, well, acts. BD does them, and I kind of, I don't know, go unconscious, get amnesia, some damn thing."
"Oh, you liar," she thought. "You remember everything. It's in your eyes. It's even in the way your mouth turns down at the corners."
And now, everything's in Darcellin's hands.
He raised one of her hands to his lips and kissed the back of it, as if to emphasize this point.
You know that old punchline, the one that goes, I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you. That doesn't apply here. I could never kill you. Everything I do, everything I've built, modest as it would look to some people, I guess I've done and built for you. For the kids, too, of course, but mostly for you. You walked into my life, and do you know what happened?
You stopped,
she said. He broke into a radiant grin. For over 20 years.
16,
she thought, but didn't say. For most of those years, when we were raising the kids and struggling to get the coin business off the ground, although that was mostly you, I was racing around New England doing taxes and setting up foundations.
You were the one who made it work,
she said, and was a little shocked by what she heard in her voice. Calmness and warmth.
You were the one with the expertise.
He looked almost touched enough to start crying again, and when he spoke, his voice was husky. Thank you, hon. It means the world to hear you say that. You saved me, you know, in more ways than one.
He cleared his throat.
For a dozen years, BD never made a peep. I thought he was gone, I honestly did. But then he came back, like a ghost.
He seemed to consider this, then nodded his head very slowly.
That's what he is, a ghost, a bad one. He started pointing out women when I was traveling. Look at that one. She wants to make sure you see her nipples, but if you touch them, she'd call the police and then laugh with her friends when they took you away. Look at that one, licking her lips with her tongue. She knows you'd like her to put it in your mouth, and she knows you know she never will. Look at that one showing off her panties when she gets out of her car. And if you think that's an accident, you're an idiot. She's just one more snoot who thinks she'll never get what she deserves.
He stopped, his eyes once more dark and downcast. In them was the Bobby who had successfully evaded her for 27 years, the one he was trying to pass off as a ghost.
When I started to have those urges, I fought them. There are magazines, certain magazines. I bought them before we got married, and I thought if I did that again, or certain sites on the internet. I thought I could, I don't know, substitute fantasy for reality, I guess you'd say. But once you've tried the real thing, fantasy isn't worth a damn.
He was talking, Darcy thought, like a man who had fallen in love with some expensive delicacy. Caviar, truffles, Belgian chocolates.
But the point is, I stopped. For all those years, I stopped. And I could stop again, Darcy, this time for good. If there's a chance for us, if you could forgive me and just turn the page.
He looked at her, earnest and wet-eyed.
Is it possible you could do that?
She thought of a woman buried in a snowdrift, her naked legs exposed by the careless swipe of a passing plow. Some mother's daughter, once the apple of some father's eye, as she danced clumsily across a grammar school stage in a pink tutu. She thought of a mother and son, discovered in a freezing creek, their hair rippling in the black ice-edged water. She thought of the woman with her head in the corn.
I'd have to think about it, she said, very carefully.
He grasped her by the upper arms and leaned toward her. She had to force herself not to flinch and to meet his eyes.
They were his eyes, and they weren't.
Maybe there's something to that ghost business after all, she thought.
This isn't one of those movies where the psycho husband chases his screaming wife all around the house. If you decide to go to the police and turn me in, I won't lift a finger to stop you, but I know you've thought about what it would do to the kids. You wouldn't be the woman I married if you hadn't thought about that. What you might not have thought about is what it would do to you. Nobody would believe that you were married to me all these years and never knew, or at least suspected. You'd have to move away and live on what savings there are, because I've always been the breadwinner, and a man can't win bread when he's in jail. You might not even be able to get at what there is because of the civil suits. And of course the kids.
Stop it. Don't talk about them when you talk about this. Don't you ever.
He nodded humbly, still holding lightly to her forearms. I beat BD once. I beat him for 20 years.
16, she thought again. 16, and you know it.
And I can beat him again. With your help, Darce, with your help, I can do anything. Even if he were to come back in another 20 years. So what? Big deal. I'd be 73. Hard to go snoot hunting when you're shuffling around in a walker.
He laughed cheerily at this absurd image, then sobered again.
But, now listen to me carefully. If I were ever to backslide, even one single time, I'd kill myself. The kids would never know. They'd never have to be touched by stigma. Because I'd make it look like an accident. But you'd know. And you'd know why. So what do you say? Can we put this behind us?
She appeared to consider. She was considering, in fact, although such thought processes as she could muster were probably not trending in a direction he would be likely to understand. What she thought was, it's what drug addicts say. I'll never take any of that stuff again. I've quit before, and this time I'll quit for good. I mean it. But they don't mean it. Even when they think they do, they don't. And neither does he.
What she thought was,
what am I going to do? I can't fool him. We've been married too long.
A cold voice replied to that, one she had never suspected of being inside her, one perhaps related to the BD voice that whispered to Bob about the snoots it observed in restaurants, laughing on street corners, riding in expensive sports cars with the top down, whispering and smiling to each other on apartment building balconies. Or perhaps it was the voice of the darker girl.
Why can't you?
It asked.
After all, he fooled you.
And what then? She didn't know. She only knew that was now, and now had to be dealt with.
You have to promise to stop, she said, speaking very slowly and reluctantly. Your most solemn never-go-back promise. His face filled with a relief so total, so somehow boyish, that she was touched. He so seldom looked like the boy he had been. Of course, that was also the boy who had once planned to go to school with guns.
I would, Darcy. I do promise. I already told you.
And we could never talk about this again.
I get that.
You're not to send the Duval woman's ID to the police either.
She saw the disappointment, also weirdly boyish, that came over his face when she said that, but she meant to stick to it. He had to feel punished, if only a little. That way he'd believe he had convinced her.
Hasn't he? Oh, Darcellin, hasn't he? I need more than promises, Bobby. Actions speak louder than words. Dig a hole in the woods and bury that woman's ID cards in it.
Once I do that, are we?
She reached out and put her hand to his mouth. She strove to make herself sound stern. Hush, no more.
Okay. Thank you, Darcy. So much.
I don't know what you're thanking me for.
And then, although the thought of him lying next to her filled her with revulsion and dismay,
She forced herself to say the rest. Now get undressed and come to bed. We both need to get some sleep.
10. He was under almost as soon as his head hit the pillow, but long after he'd commenced his small, polite snores, Darcy lay awake, thinking that if she allowed herself to drift off, she would awake with his hands around her throat. She was in bed with a madman, after all. If he added her, his score would be an even dozen.
But he meant it, she thought.
This was right around the time that the sky began to lighten in the east.
He said he loves me, and he meant it. And when I said I'd keep his secret, because that's what it comes down to, keeping his secret, he believed me. Why wouldn't he? I almost convinced myself.
Wasn't it possible he could carry through on his promise? Not all drug addicts failed at getting clean, after all. And while she could never keep his secret for herself, wasn't it possible she could for the kids?
I can't. I won't. But what choice?
What goddamn choice? It was while pondering this question that her tired, confused mind finally gave up and slipped away. She dreamed of going into the dining room and finding a woman bound with chains to the long Ethan Allen table there. The woman was naked except for a black leather hood that covered the top half of her face.
I don't know that woman. That woman is a stranger to me, she thought in her dream.
And then from beneath the hood, Petra said,
Mama, is that you?
Darcy tried to scream, but sometimes in nightmares, you can't. 11. When she finally struggled awake, headachy, miserable, feeling hungover, the other half of the bed was empty. Bob had turned his clock back around, and she saw it was 10:15. It was the latest she'd slept in years, but of course she hadn't dropped off until first light, and such sleep as she'd gotten was populated with horrors. She used the toilet, dragged her house coat off the hook on the back of the bathroom door, then brushed her teeth. Her mouth tasted foul.
Like the bottom of a birdcage, Bob would say on the rare mornings after he'd taken an extra glass of wine with dinner or a second bottle of beer during a baseball game.
She spat, began to put her brush back in the tooth glass, then paused, looking at her reflection. This morning she saw a woman who looked old instead of middle-aged. Pale skin, deep lines bracketing the mouth, purple bruises under the eyes, the crazed bedhead you only got from tossing and turning. But all this was only of passing interest to her. How she looked was the last thing on her mind. She peered over her reflection's shoulder and through the open bathroom door into their bedroom. Except it wasn't theirs. It was the darker bedroom. She could see his slippers. Only they weren't his. They were obviously too big to be Bob's. Almost a giant's slippers. They belonged to the darker husband. And the double bed with the wrinkled sheets and unanchored blankets? That was the darker bed. She shifted her gaze back to the wild-haired woman with the bloodshot, frightened eyes, the darker wife in all her raddled glory. Her first name was Darcy, but her last name wasn't Anderson. The darker wife was Mrs. Brian Delahanty. Darcy leaned forward until her nose was touching the glass. She held her breath and cupped her hands to the sides of her face, just as she had when she was a girl dressed in grass-stained shorts and falling-down white socks. She looked until she couldn't hold her breath any longer, then exhaled in a huff that fogged the mirror. She wiped it clean with a towel, and then went downstairs to face her first day as the monster's wife. He had left a note for her under the sugar bowl.
Darce, I will take care of those documents as you asked. I love you, honey. Bob.
He had drawn a little Valentine around his name, a thing he hadn't done in years. She felt a wave of love for him as thick and cloying as the scent of dying flowers. She wanted to wail like some woman in an Old Testament story and stifled the sound with a napkin. The refrigerator kicked on and began its heartless whir. Water dripped in the sink, plinking away the seconds on the porcelain. Her tongue was a sour sponge crammed into her mouth. She felt time, all the time to come as his wife in this house, close around her like a straitjacket. Or a coffin. This was the world she had believed in as a child. It had been here all the time, waiting for her. The refrigerator whirred. The water dripped in the sink, and the raw seconds passed. This was the darker life, where every truth was written backward. 12. Her husband had coached Little League, also with Vinnie Eschler, that master of Polish jokes and big enveloping man-hugs, during the years when Donnie had played shortstop for the Cavendish hardware team, and Darcy still remembered what Bob said to the boys, many of them weeping, after they'd lost the final game of the District 19 tourney. Back in 1997, that would have been, probably only a month or so before Bob had murdered Stacy Moore and stuffed her into her corn bin. The talk he'd given to that bunch of drooping, sniffling boys had been short, wise, and, she'd thought so then and still did 13 years later, incredibly kind. "I know how bad you boys feel, but the sun will still come up tomorrow. And when it does, you'll feel better. When the sun comes up the day after tomorrow, a little better still. This is just part of your life, and it's over. It would have been better to win, but either way, it's over. Life will go on." As hers did, following her ill-starred trip out to the garage for batteries. When Bob came home from work after her first long day at home, she couldn't bear the thought of going out herself, afraid her knowledge must be written on her face in capital letters. He said, "Honey, about last night."
"Nothing happened last night. You came home early, that's all."
He ducked his head in that boyish way he had. And when he raised it again, his face was lit with a large and grateful smile. "That's fine, then," he said. "Case closed?"
"Closed book."
He opened his arms. "Give us a kiss, beautiful."
She did, wondering if he had kissed them.
"Do a good job. Really use that educated tongue of yours, and I won't cut you,"
she could imagine him saying.
"Put your snooty little heart into it."
He held her away from him, his hands on her shoulders.
"Still friends?"
"Still friends."
"Sure?"
"Yes. I didn't cook anything, and I don't want to go out. Why don't you change into some grubbies and go grab us a pizza?"
"All right."
"And don't forget to take your Prilosec."
He beamed at her. "You bet."
She watched him go bounding up the stairs, thought of saying, "Don't do that, Bobby. Don't test your heart like that."
But no. No. Let him test it all he wanted.
13. The sun came up the next day, and the next. A week went by, then two, then a month. They resumed their old ways. The small habits of a long marriage. She brushed her teeth while he was in the shower, usually singing some hit from the 80s in a voice that was on key but not particularly melodious, although she no longer did it naked, meaning to step into the shower as soon as he vacated it. Now she showered after he'd left for BB&A. If he noticed this little change in her modus operandi, he didn't mention it. She resumed her book club, telling the other ladies and the two retired gentlemen who took part that she had been feeling under the weather and didn't want to pass on a virus along with her opinion of the new Barbara Kingsolver, and everyone chuckled politely.
A week after that, she resumed the knitting circle. Nuts for knitting. Sometimes she caught herself singing along with the radio when she came back from the post office or the grocery store. She and Bob watched TV at night. Always comedies, never the forensic crime shows. He came home early now. There had been no more road trips since the one to Montpelier. He got something called Skype for his computer, saying he could look at coin collections just as easily that way and save on gas. He didn't say it would also save on temptation, but he didn't have to. She watched the papers to see if Marjorie Duval's ID showed up, knowing if he had lied about that, he would lie about everything. But it didn't. Once a week they went out to dinner at one of Yarmouth's two inexpensive restaurants. He ordered steak and she ordered fish. He drank iced tea and she had a cranberry breeze. Old habits died hard. Often, she thought, they don't die until we do. In the daytime, while he was gone, she now rarely turned on the television. It was easier to listen to the refrigerator with it off, and to the small creaks and groans of their nice Yarmouth house as it settled toward another Maine winter. It was easier to think, easier to face the truth. He would do it again. He would hold off as long as he could. She would gladly give him that much, but sooner or later Beatty would gain the upper hand. He wouldn't send the next woman's ID to the police, thinking that might be enough to fool her, but probably not caring if she saw through the change in M.O. Because, he would reason, she's a part of it now. She'd have to admit she knew. The cops would get it out of her, even if she tried to hide that part. Donnie called from Ohio. The business was going great guns. They had landed an office products account that might go national. Darcy said, hooray! And so did Bob, cheerily admitting he'd been wrong about Donnie's chances of making it so young. Petra called to say they had tentatively decided on blue dresses for the bridesmaids, A-line, knee-high, matching chiffon scarves, and did Darcy think that was all right, or would outfits like that look a bit childish? Darcy said she thought they would look sweet, and the two of them went on to a discussion of shoes, blue pumps with 3/4-inch heels to be exact. Darcy's mother got sick down in Boca Grande, and it looked like she might have to go into the hospital, but then they started her on some new medication, and she got well. The sun came up, and the sun went down. The paper jack-o'-lanterns in store windows went down, and paper turkeys went up. Then the Christmas decorations went up. The first snow flurries appeared right on schedule. In her house, after her husband had taken his briefcase and gone to work, Darcy moved through the rooms, pausing to look into the various mirrors, often for a long time, asking the woman inside that other world what she should do. Increasingly, the answer seemed to be that she would do nothing. 14. On an unseasonably warm day, 2 weeks before Christmas, Bob came home in the middle of the afternoon shouting her name. Darcy was upstairs reading a book. She tossed it on the night table, beside the hand mirror that had now taken up permanent residence there, and flew down the hall to the landing. Her first thought, horror mixed with relief, was that it was finally over. He had been found out. The police would soon be here. They would take him away, then come back to ask her the two age-old questions. What did she know, and when did she know it? News vans would park on the street. Young men and women with good hair would do stand-ups in front of their house. Except that wasn't fear in his voice. She knew it for what it was even before he reached the foot of the stairs and turned his face up to her. It was excitement, perhaps even jubilation. Bob? What? You'll never believe it! His top coat hung open. His face was flushed all the way down to the forehead, and such hair as he still had was blown every which way. It was as if he had driven home with all his car windows open. Given the spring-like quality of the air, Darcy supposed he might have. She came down cautiously and stood on the first riser, which put them eye to eye.
Tell me.
The most amazing luck. Really, if I ever need a sign that I'm on the right track again, that we are, boy, this is it.
He held out his hands. They were closed into fists with the knuckles up. His eyes were sparkling, almost dancing.
Which hand? Pick.
Bob, I don't want to play
Pick!
She pointed to his right hand, just to get it over with. He laughed.
You read my mind, but you always could, couldn't you?
He turned his fist over and opened it. On his palm lay a single coin, tail side up, so she could see it was a wheat penny. Not uncirculated by any means, but still in great shape. Assuming there were no scratches on the Lincoln side, she thought it was either F or VF. She reached for it, then paused. He nodded for her to go ahead. She turned it over, quite sure of what she would see. Nothing else could adequately explain his excitement. It was what she expected. A 1955 double date. A double die, in numismatic terms.
Holy God, Bobby! Where? Did you buy it?
An uncirculated 55 double die had recently sold at an auction in Miami for over $8,000, setting a new record. This one wasn't in that kind of shape, but no coin dealer with half a brain would have let it go for under four.
God, no! Some of the other fellows invited me to lunch at that Thai place, Eastern Promises, and I almost went, but I was working the goddarn Vision Associates account. You know, the private bank I told you about. So I gave Monica $10 and told her to get me a sandwich and a Fruitopia at Subway. She brought it back with the change in the bag. I shook it out, and there it was.
He plucked the penny from her hand and held it over his head, laughing up at it. She laughed with him, then thought, as these days she often did,
he did not suffer.
Isn't it great, honey?
Yes,
she said.
I'm happy for you.
And odd or not, perverse or not, she really was. He had brokered sales of several over the years and could have bought one for himself any old time, but that wasn't the same as just coming across one. He had even forbidden her to give him one for Christmas or his birthday. The great accidental find was a collector's most joyous moment. He had said so during their first real conversation, and now he had what he had been checking handfuls of change for all his life. His heart's desire had come spilling out of a white sandwich shop paper bag, along with a turkey bacon wrap. He enveloped her in a hug. She hugged him back, then pushed him gently away.
What are you going to do with it, Bobby? Put it in a lucite cube?
This was a tease, and he knew it. He cocked a finger gun and shot her in the head, which was all right, because when you were shot with a finger gun, you did not suffer. She continued to